seated, please. Court is ready to hear argument in 050126, the City of Rock Hall versus Vester T. Hughes.
May it please the court, Mr. Terry Morgan will present argument for petitioners have reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court, the Hughes opinion jeopardizes the planning growth of every home rule city that intends to expand its boundaries through annexation of vacant land, and it does so in two ways. The first way is that it undoes the statutory compromise that was put into Senate Bill 89 in order that allows cities to annex vacant land as long as there are fewer than 100 occupied parcels. Effectively, through the method of injunction and reading into the statutory provision in subsection I, a right to enjoin the annexation pending arbitration, it effectively creates a developer's remedy. The developer's remedy because the developer is a chief beneficiary of this section, which is narrowly drawn as to its remedial aspects. The second way in which the Hughes opinion jeopardizes the planned growth of cities is that it removes the protection of the quo warranto doctrine in a circumstance in which the policy underpinnings of that doctrine are called into question. And the opinion has pronounced that the arbitration provision in subsection I effectively is a private right of action that allows a party to attack annexation proceedings on procedural grounds. And yet the opinion did so without examining the fact that there's no provision for a stay in that arbitration provision. And secondly, without examining the consequences of multiple arbitration proceedings that are easily filed. And in fact, in this case, there are two petitions to arbitrate. What result is that any landowner, one that cannot possibly qualify as this applicant for inclusion in a three-year planning process, can derail the annexation while it vests its property rights and thus avoids the city's land use planning ability. And we submit that given the statutory context, the legislature could not have intended that result.
Does the City of Rockwall have a three-year planning process, annexation process?
The City of Rockwall has a plan that was adopted in 1999, Your Honor. And basically it states that the city will not engage in annexations that require a three-year planning process.
So it had none.
Well, it has that statement, and it has no proposal to annex occupied parcels. That's correct.
Is it true, as the Municipal League tells us, that hardly anybody does? Hardly any city?
Well, I can't answer that hardly anybody is. I'm aware of some cities, in fact, that are proceeding with three-year annexation plans to date. So I don't know whether that statement is correct. I know that there are cities that don't have them, as Rockwall does not have them.
Mm-hmm. What is the objection to the three-year, the city's objection to the three-year process?
Well, I don't think the fact that they adopted a 1999 plan saying that they would not proceed with a occupied parcel annexations indicates that they never will. But the primary reason is a difference in purpose. And when you have occupied territory, particularly an area that contains 100 occupied parcels, the services pattern, the development pattern is already there by definition. It is of less interest and of less urgency to the city to annex such property because it's already served. It wouldn't be houses if there weren't sewer and water or septic services in some regard. Quite a different concern arises when there's a vacant land annexation because that development pattern has not yet occurred. And for that reason, the city's focus has been, when it does annex, to annex vacant land and not populated areas. It doesn't mean that it won't do so in the future, though.
But what is the objection to the process? It just takes too much time, or parties can change their positions while it's pending?
The city's chief objective in annexing, as is stated in that plan, is really to protect its own planning process. As I say, Your Honor, when you have occupied territory that you're looking at, not only there are many objections in terms of residents, but the development pattern itself has been established. And the facilities are already there, so there's no urgency to adopt those particular tracts of land. And, of course, the citizens frequently object to any annexation. And so for that reason, there's no urgency. There is an urgency, however, with vacant land annexations because of the statutory framework in which cities find themselves.
Do you agree with the Municipal League's statement in their brief that the as-filed version of Senate Bill 89 would have significantly restricted the annexation authority of all cities?
I do believe that's correct, Your Honor, in the sense that it requires now a three-year planning process on one set of annexations.
And as it worked out, in your view, it really doesn't change very much at all, Senate Bill 89.
Well, no, I would not agree, Your Honor. I think that the Senate Bill 89 establishes two separate tracks for annexation.
And one of which is not used.
Pardon?
One of which is never used.
Well, if you don't use them, that's true. I guess the city would not be affected by a process that it doesn't intend to use,
right,
at least in the short run.
Well, but I guess my question is, it seems to suggest that Senate Bill 89 was really going to turn the world around. And fortunately, that didn't happen. And so a lot of compromise was worked out. I'm just kind of paraphrasing here, but I think that's fair. And in the end, we have a statute that really has not affected the process at all.
Well, it certainly has affected the process, I believe. And one way it's affected the process is that we're here today on an arbitration request.
If you win, it won't affect it at all.
Cities that choose not to annex occupied territory, Your Honor, would not be affected significantly by the passage of Senate Bill 89.
Yeah.
That's correct.
Why would they pass a bill like that?
Well, because there's a lot of areas that would be affected. A lot of areas, and I believe that's reflected in the T of L amicus brief as well as in some of the authorities that have been cited, is the principal focus of the legislature was the annexation of occupied subdivisions. That's how we got a 100-track rule. You know, this 100-track rule is not a low bar. If the legislature were so concerned about putting all annexations as the state suggests here, into a three-year planning process, it wouldn't have set the bar at 100 parcels that are occupied. That's pretty high. And that reflects the legislative intent that these occupied subdivisions, which were being annexed, in fact, that's the legislative history, or that's the background, I should say, for Senate Bill 89, that was a concern. Those particular annexations are on a much different track. Some cities will be affected, others will not. And I think the bright line component of subsection H, H1 in particular, is a very clear rule. It has its own procedures. All of subsection H has its own procedures. Much of the theory of the estate in this case actually is premised on the idea that somehow H1 is an exception to the statutory scheme. Not once in the statute is the word exception used. What subsection H states in its opening premise is that the procedures of the three-year plan do not apply to the following types of annexations. And the very first one listed is one that has a standard right included in it, namely a 100-unit rule. It's an easy rule to follow. It's a rule, in fact, that all it requires is counting occupied parcels. If you look at under subchapter C1, there's a procedure that actually refers back to H1. It is clearly intended that annexations will proceed. Vacant land annexations may proceed as under the prior statute, and it may proceed expeditiously, and it's not by accident. It's not by accident because if you look at the background of this statute and look at the statutory framework, the city of Rockwall had a plan for the area that was annexed. It was a rural residential development plan in which the density was 2 units an acre. The estate proposed a development of 4 units an acre. The background of state law essentially is that a city may plan in its extraterritorial jurisdiction for its future territory, but it may not implement that plan until the land is within the city. It may not pass zoning regulations. And consequently, the city has a very vital interest in annexing expeditiously before a land use pattern is established and also before vesting of property rights.
But is it right that when the landowner is given notification that the city intends to proceed under H1, then the landowner can request a 3-year annexation plan, and if there's no action on that, can seek arbitration. Is that the way that statute works? Or?
Well, the statute, subsection I, Your Honor, does allow in certain limited circumstances a property owner, if he falls within the narrow confines of the way it's defined, to first, as you say, a two-step process request that his land be included, or rather that the area be included in a three-year plan, and failing that, if the city takes no action, then he can request arbitration, as occurred in this case. And in this case...
When would it ever occur? It's hard to see when it would ever occur.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
When would the arbitration sentence in subparagraph I, when would that ever be implemented? If the city were stupid and just sat on it, but if it denied
well,
it.
Well, you have to understand it, I believe, Judge, in view of the time frames, which are very short. A city can complete annexation under subchapter C1 in 60 days. There's a set procedure for doing so, two hearings, time between the last hearing and the time of first reading of the ordinance, but it's a quick procedure. If a landowner asks for, to be included in a three-year plan, the city sits on it, that remedy, or rather any consideration of whether it should be in a three-year plan, is lost. And there are other precedents in the statute for dilatory conduct.
But why would a city ever just not act on it when it could deny it and avoid arbitration, which it doesn't want?
Well, I think given the time frames and how narrow they or how tight they are, I believe a city might simply just have not noticed it or took its time in between council meetings to decide it. I mean, there's some realities here, and some practical realities that the legislature is surely aware of.
Is even if that happened, which seems to me kind of unlikely, but if it did, and the city just didn't notice it was there and didn't act on it, then the city could still just ignore the request for arbitration unless there was a quo warranto action to enforce it.
It could indeed, and we have to take that position. We're not denying that this remedy is essentially a matter of agreement between the city, but the city has a pretty good reason for doing so, and that is the quo warranto form itself. The assumption of the Court of Appeals was that quo warranto is a completely ineffective remedy, and that the legislature carved this exception out carved this procedure out to get around it. But that is not necessarily so. I think this, quo warranto could be brought not only by the Attorney General, but by every district attorney in every county in Texas. I think it's a real restraint on cities actually just ignoring a statutory procedure.
So does 43052 give a private landowner any right at any time under any circumstances to sue for an order compelling arbitration?
No, it doesn't. And it has to, the property owner essentially, well, let me put it differently. The Court of Appeals doesn't address it. The estate argues that there's absolutely no burden of any property owner to show entitlement before the city that it qualifies. The actual criteria in subsection I, the sentence that starts off that section, says if the city proposes to annex separately an area that essentially should have been annexed under under the three-year plan, then a landowner may proceed to request it. Ironically, if the legislature were so concerned about abuse of this provision, so that it created a procedure to end run around the quo warranto procedure in general and the doctrine, why did it not at least give those property owners a right who would be, perhaps an example is the easiest way to answer that. If a city chooses to annex 500 parcels in one annexation expeditiously without going through H3, there's not a remedy under subsection I. That property owner cannot commit
to it. So even when the city fails to act one way or the other, they sit on it for whatever reason, there's still no private right of action to compel arbitration.
Well, that's correct, Judge. We take that position. I have to say that there's no comfortable and completely satisfactory interpretation of this statute. You have to look at it against the backdrop of a clear legislative intent to give cities the right to expeditiously annex land, and secondly, the backdrop of the quo warranto doctrine. The absence of a stay provision in subsection I it had to be read in by the Court of Appeals. In contrast, for example, to the stay provision that is found in 430564, I think suggests strongly that the legislature did not intend this statute to be an effective alternative or one that could be enforced and compelled through arbitration.
In the procedural substantive rubric of the briefs, I take it you think the first sentence of paragraph I is procedural too.
I certainly do. And I think
it kind of looks like it's limiting a municipality's power, but then it says no reason exists, which doesn't seem like much of a limitation.
Well, it,
I mean,
it does.
It's an arguable thing.
It certainly is arguable, Your Honor, and three courts have found that the entire section and a challenge to whether H1 operates is, in fact, at least if it occurs once the annexation is complete, has to be brought by pro warranto. And that's reasonable as well, because the whole focus of a three-year planning process is a service plan. Alexander Royal holds that service planning, violations of a service plan are procedural in character. This is a procedure to effect a procedure. Time's up, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear arguments from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Matthew Molesh will present arguments for the respondent.
May it please the court, the provision in 43052I that gives the landowner, the petitioner, the specific right to request arbitration with the city does not jeopardize the city's planning process.
But it does force it into a three-year plan.
It can force it into a three-year plan.
Wouldn't it always throw it into a three-year? I mean, is there, unless you just wanted annexation, you could always essentially force it in, or almost always force it into a three-year plan.
Justice Tech, we would have the right, as the legislature contemplated, to ask an arbitrator to determine the merits of whether the city was trying to circumvent the requirement of a three-year plan. The arbitrator could decide, no, they're not, and go ahead and finish the annexation.
But I was looking at it practically. I mean, their concern that there could be multiple requests for arbitration is a valid one, it seems like to me.
There is a possibility of that. I don't think it's a reality. It's very practical because of the short time frame that is involved with the H1 annexation, and also because of the cost-shifting provision that the legislature included in 43052I. What the legislature did was they started out with a statute that was proposed that everything had to be in a three-year plan. So they started out in Senate Bill 89 with there not being an H1 exception. Then after some committee work, there was an H1 exception added. And then on the floor of the House, there were amendments to that that would have eliminated the H1 exception altogether again, and said if you're not in a three-year plan, you have to get the consent of the landowners, 50% of the landowners that live in that area, to agree to the annexation. It then went to a joint committee with a very unusual process, and it came out with the current statute. And what the current statute represents is a balance that the legislature struck, and the important part of that balance is the check on the city's abuse of the H1 exception that is expressly granted to the landowners.
Well, see, it's the balance part that I'm missing, because it seems to me the petitioner's position is that I just mean nothing unless the city wants to mean something, which it never would because it's not in its interest. But then it seems like the respondent's position is, oh, yes, we can do this, but the concerns that have gone into quo warranto limitations are still there, and as a practical matter, although not as a legal one, but as a practical matter, I just forces the cities to have three-year plans.
Well, the same concerns that underlie the Alexander Oil opinion, for example, could exist in some circumstances, but the legislature is presumed to have understood that and have made a decision that they're going to provide this check to the landowners. They've decided that in this instance, the way the statute is drafted, those are acceptable possible consequences. There might be a situation where there's more than one arbitration. There might not be, but the legislature decided we're going to let the landowners keep the cities honest. We're going to force them to plan. And one of the major reasons there's not likely to be a serial set of arbitrations, two reasons. One, the short time frame in which this arbitration can occur, and two, the risk that the person that comes second will have the cost of the arbitration award against them. And that's a significant deterrent to arbitration after arbitration after arbitration by different landowners. That's the why I call it a balance, Justice Heft, is because the legislature had to look at all this, and say, okay, we're not going to require a three-year plan, but we're a little worried about these cities. We don't want them circumventing this requirement, so we're going to give the landowners that live there a chance to have some rights. And it's a departure from prior law, but it's a choice that the legislature made, and it's a balance that the legislature struck in order to give these landowners the right to ask the city to plan if they should be planning. And that's all we're asking for in this case, is that the court recognize that a landowner who lives in an area that's in the city's ETJ has a right, when threatened with involuntary annexation, to look at that and say, wait, you're not doing the right thing. You are annexing everything under H1. You've never had a three-year plan. You're arranging the areas in a way that you don't have to, arguably don't have to use it. And we want to take that to an arbitrator. And we follow the procedures. We should have the right to arbitrate that.
And is the arbitration about whether it should go in the plan or not?
Yes.
And that's it?
Yes.
But I guess when I think of balance, this is, I think of something in the middle, and this seems to me that it's going to be tilted one way or the other pretty severely.
And I actually had the same reaction when thinking about this argument today, Justice Heck, that balance might not be the right word, because balance involves equal. The legislature doesn't always have to make something equal between the parties. What they do is they strike the correct position. They decide, these are the rights we're going to give to the cities, these are the rights we're going to give to the landowners, these are the obligations we're going to put on the city, and these are the obligations that we're going to allow a landowner to enforce. There's many things in the annexation statute that the landowners cannot enforce. There's still a place for Alexander Oil and for the Coronado Doctrine. If there's a failure of notice, for example, or something along those lines, then Alexander Oil would still apply. We are only asking that the court recognize that the legislature gave a very specific right in 43052I. They gave a specific right to a specific person, a landowner or a resident that lives in the area that is to be annexed under H1. And what they said was, you can arbitrate, and they adopted a procedure to make that arbitration very quick and very efficient. They adopted the procedures from another section that say the parties have to try to agree on the arbitrator. If they can't, they'll be appointed in about 11 days. The arbitrator, he or she, has to then set a hearing on this issue within 10 days. And I believe the intent was that this arbitration would occur within the 60 or 90-day periods that cities use to involuntary annex land under H1. If the cities would agree that they are obligated to arbitrate, this could have all been done. There'd been no need for any kind of relief from the court with respect to this matter, and we would have been either annexed under H1 or they would have had us in a three-year plan.
I don't suppose anybody knows why arbitration rather than going to court to get it resolved.
Well, in the legislative history, there's a lot of discussion about the use of arbitration. It was considered to be very important to the overall bill that was passed by the legislature. That was a key provision if you look at some of the comments the legislature's made. And arbitration is sprinkled throughout the statute. There are other places where the legislature selected arbitration for this particular situation, meaning annexation generally, as the preferred remedy that either a landowner or someone else gets to use. There's two or three other places in the statute where it appears in this bill.
In resolving disputes with the cities.
In resolving disputes over annexation-related matters with the cities.
Counsel, if this provision is not in about arbitration and the city is annexing using the quick method, regardless of whether we take the statute or not, and they give notice that they're going to annex, the landowner, absent this provision, we just take this one out, the landowner can protest, I guess. Is that correct?
If 43052I is not in the statute.
About the request for arbitration.
If there's no right to request that, all they can do is complain and hope that the city will change their mind.
Okay, but the process is entirely within the city's hands, and the city, and they write a letter to the city or a series of letters, and the city can just put them in the file and ignore them, and the process completes itself. Is that correct?
Well, there are hearing requirements that are part of the annexation, and so there they would have the opportunity to appear at those hearings and make statements as well.
Okay, but the city could just give them a hearing, they could stand up, and the city could ignore them and then just complete the process.
Without the 43052I check, that is a possibility.
And take no action on their letters and complaints. The city could just ignore them. Now, in this process, is that a correct statement? I mean, the city could just listen to them and sit and listen and say, okay, you've had your hearing now, we're going to go on with our deal.
Without 43052I.
Right. Now, and in this one it says, reading the statutory language, looking at the Court of Appeals opinions, they quoted, if the municipality fails to take action on the petition, petitioner may request arbitration. At that point, if the city just starts the process, gets these complaints, does nothing about the complaints, takes no action on the petition, that certainly gives you the right to arbitrate, to request arbitration.
That would be one situation where you'd have the right to arbitrate, but the more likely situation is what the city does is they say no, which is what they did in this case.
But this does, in fact, if we simply take the city's position, this requires them to take some action to address the landowner's complaint. Is that in addition to, or would that be addressed in the process with this provision not even in there?
Apologize if I don't completely understand your question. Please let me know so I can answer it more directly. If I understand your question, if 43052I were not in the statute, then the city would not have to respond to anything the landowner did.
You still have to give them hearings, but they don't have to respond.
They don't have to.
What I'm wondering is does this add anything to the process if we adopt the city's position?
No, it does not. 43052I becomes meaningless if you adopt the city's position.
But they do have to respond. It does require them to respond in some nature, either deny or talk to you or take a position.
The city, even with 43052I in place, the city could do nothing. They could not say yes or no, and then you would have the right to arbitrate under the city's own view. But what 43052I contemplates, I believe, is the city is going to fail to include you in a three-year plan, either by inaction or more likely by denying your petition to be included. And it's that instance, the one that the issue in this case, where the landowner can then say, wait, I have a right to arbitrate. I get to go to an arbitrator under this very quick expedited process, and I get to convince the arbitrator that what you're doing is circumventing the three-year planning requirement.
And what are the factors to be presented to the arbitrator? Should he decide to go contrary to the community's will as represented by the council and force them to go through the three-year plan?
Under 43052I, the arbitrator would consider whether there were any generally accepted municipal planning principles and practices for separately annexing these areas. So the standard would be, is the city planning? And that's exactly what doesn't happen here. Rockwall says that if you adopt the Court of Appeals view of 43052I, you'll jeopardize planning. You won't. You'll force them to plan, because what happened in this case and what happens usually is this land sits out in the ETJ maybe for decades, and the city doesn't do anything with respect to it. They don't say they're going to annex it. They don't do anything. And then someone decides they want to develop it, and they react. And what they do is they react by starting the H1 annexation process. And that's what happens here. And our position is that reacting to a proposed development is not planning. What the legislature wanted them to do, and cities do this, some cities do this, they adopt a three-year plan and say, we're going to annex you in the future, in 2 years, in 3 years, or whatever it might be. And that's what 43052I is supposed to do, make sure the cities are going through the planning process.
But they worry that landowners will scramble around and still try to avoid the planning and regulatory consequences of annexation during the three-year period.
Well, what landowners can do is vest rights during the three-year period, and that's something expressly contemplated by the legislature. There's been not only a statute adopted in connection with this section, but other statutes that give the property owners the right to vest rights. The one here, for example, says that if you had a plan for your property that was in place before they annex you, then you can continue to develop your land in connection with that plan. We have that plan in place, and what actually triggered this annexation, as shown in the record, is we filed the requisite, made the first requisite filing with the city. And so they knew that we were going to then develop the land. That's when they raised their hand and said, I want to annex you. And we said, no, that's not right. You should put us in a three-year plan. We petitioned. They refused. We timely demanded arbitration. They refused. And that's when we took the step of filing the suit to compel arbitration. And that was the relief we requested. That specifically provided for under 43052I.
Just as I mentioned a while ago, the substantive procedural rubric. Is this substantive or is this procedural, or does it make a difference in your view?
It doesn't make a difference. Under Alexander Oil says that if the legislature specifically provides a right, then quorumanto doesn't apply. So I don't think you can label this as procedural or substantive and make any decision based on Alexander Oil, the quorumanto doctrine. What is important under that case and under the other case law that construes that doctrine is that the legislature acted directly and specifically to grant a right.
And the right given was to request, in the event the city did not take action, you agreed to it.
The right was to arbitrate with the city whether that land should be included in a three-year plan, yes. And if you consider what the effect would be of Rockwall's interpretation, this is really a case with one issue, and that is, what does the statute mean? It's a narrow issue for the court of statutory construction. And part of that, of course, is what did the legislature intend by this statute? And one rule of statutory construction is you should not construe the statute to lead to an absurd result or a result that's ineffective. And if you adopt Rockwall's interpretation, this will be an ineffective statute. And consider what the situation would be if you adopted Rockwall's view of the statute. A landowner would...
Before you get there, let me just... you don't want to have an illegal result either. And it's sometimes argued that there are constitutional problems with requiring cities or governmental agencies to arbitrate because it basically delegates ultimate decision-making over policy matters that are in dispute to a private entity. And that argument has been made in the fire employee and police disagreement arbitrations. But tell me two things. I've forgotten whether there is an appeal from these arbitration decisions.
The statute does not expressly provide for an appeal. Under common law, there would be the common law right that exists outside of the arbitration statute to challenge an arbitration award on very, very limited basis.
And the other, is it true that the arbitration in the sections 43056 and following regarding negotiations with landowners in the three-year plan, that arbitration does have an appeal, or do you remember? I don't remember.
The other section does have some additional procedural rules that were not incorporated here, but I think that is not relevant to considering what the legislature rather intended by this section. I think it makes sense that they didn't incorporate some of those sections. They were unnecessary. The negotiation of the service plan is a completely different situation, a completely different animal. It goes on for an extended period of time, probably a number of years, and the whole structure of that is different than the structure of this very quick process that we have an issue here.
And I don't suppose there was much discussion in the legislative history about delegation issues.
The constitutional issue, I don't recall anything on that, and that's not an issue that Rockwall's raised in their case, so we've not considered or responded to that. to consider what the effect of the Rockwall's interpretation would be, we just walk through what would happen when a petitioner receives notice that the property is going to be annexed under the H1 exception. He would, or she would, petition for inclusion in a three-year plan. The city would do nothing on the petition for some unspecified period of time. We don't know what that is under Rockwall interpretation. Is it a day or a week or a month or how long is it? It's not stated in the statute or under their interpretation. The landowner, or it's not really clear here if it's the landowner or the attorney general, but someone petitions for inclusion, for arbitration rather, the city still does nothing, just doesn't act. So the landowner or the AG, under Rockwall's view, says, let's arbitrate. And so then the city, under the statute, the procedures that are adopted, has to begin trying to agree on the identity of an arbitrator. And if they can't agree, they go to AAA and get a list, and they strike the list like a usual arbitration. And under Rockwall's view, the city still doesn't do anything. The city's clearly on notice that this landowner wants to arbitrate, still does nothing, and the process continues like that. It makes no sense what they're proposing. Thank you.
Thank you, Council. How does your argument make sense?
How does our argument make sense, Your Honor? Well, as I said before, there's no way to get all of the parts of this together. It makes sense from the context of the question before the court. The question is whether this particular arbitration procedure is actually intended to avoid the quo warranto doctrine. And under our view, if you look at and you compare the arbitration in the reference statute, that's 430564, it has several provisions and safeguards which this statute does not have. For example, it has a stay provision.
As a what?
A stay. Annexation cannot be accomplished under any other method while arbitration and appeals, which that statute provides for, are going forward. You'll find that in subsection A of 430564. This statute says nothing about staying. If the legislature was so concerned about the quo warranto remedy being ineffective, which is the basic premise that's being advanced here, then surely it would have put a stay in the statute. In fact, the Court of Appeals, assuming what had to be proved, read a stay into it and basically enjoined the city from proceeding with arbitration. So to make this an effective remedy, guess what? You have to go to court every time, and here's a good reason. Even if this becomes sudden law, if you look at the time frames, a city can annex land under H1 in 60 days, and if you go through the arbitration process, it takes about 70 just to get to a hearing. In every case, a city can agree to arbitrate, and in order to avoid the city completing its annexation proceedings before arbitration is even, the first hearing is held, a city is going to have to, or the applicant, the landowner, is going to have to get a court and enjoin the city. As soon as the city is enjoined, if you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, there's no reciprocal injunction on the ability of a property owner to vest his rights under 43002. And what happens while the city is enjoined, he can walk, and if the city, by the way, if the injunction comes before the city reads the ordinance for the first time, and there's 20 days in between the last hearing and the first reading of the ordinance by statute, that proceeding is going to have to start over again because you've got to have the first reading of the ordinance within 20 days of the hearing. That's plenty of time for the landowner to come in and vest, file an application while arbitration's going on. Pretty small price to pay if you can vest your right to 1,500 units and pay the cost of arbitration if the arbitrator subsequently decides that it wasn't a well-founded request for arbitration. That's the contrast between, and I realize that to say that the city could ignore this proceeding altogether and refuse to arbitrate and there's nothing that can be done to enforce it, it's not all that comfortable a position. But I think it's also founded on the premise that quo warranto is an effective remedy for procedural violations, and there's nothing better to illustrate that than the structure of subsection I itself. It would be incredible for the legislature to craft this remedy as an end run around subsection I and not give the same right to a property owner that was in an area, if anybody counted, where there's 200 occupied parcels. That landowner, if he happens to be in here, he can't request arbitration. In order to request arbitration, the only standards that you can do so is if the city proposes to annex two areas, each of which contains less than 100 parcels. If the legislature were so concerned about quo warranto not being an effective remedy, surely it would have given that property owner the right to request arbitration and compel it as well. And finally, the other contrast here is the fact that there will be multiple arbitration proceedings, and there's absolutely no indication in the statute how those proceedings are resolved.
Any further questions? Chief, can I ask one question?
Yes, Justice.
What does this provision add to the process if it gives the city the right to say we're not going to put you in a three-year process, and then the city has the right to refuse arbitration? What does it add at all?
It provides a provisional remedy, Your Honor, by which the city can agree to arbitration and have the dispute resolved that way as an alternative to facing a quo warranto proceeding where, in fact, the entire annexation can be voided.
And could the city not have done that anyway, even in the absence of this provision?
The city could have. I suppose the city could. There's no provision expressly in the statute to stay in annexation in order to arbitrate, but I suppose the city could make a contract along those lines.
Could agree to it.
Yes, sir.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument and all arguments for this morning, and the marshal will now adjourn the court.
All rise.